From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. As President Obama pitches his economic rescue plan directly to the American people, the country is reeling from record job losses last month. One state is forcing workers to stay home 2 days a month with no pay. And federal regulators shut down three more banks over the weekend. We've got author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux here with us to dissect the latest in the economic news. Hello, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Well, I'm glad to have a job, let's put it that way.
You know, that's a good thing.
Businesses and institutions have now shed jobs for the last 13 months in a row. Last month alone, we lost nearly 600,000 jobs. Nissan is the latest to announce big cuts. President Obama, Dr. Malveaux, has warned of double-digit unemployment rates. It seems like every time I have you on the show, we ask the same question. How high is unemployment going to go?
Well, the rate we're going, it can get to double digit. The last time we've seen anything like that was in 1981 in the early Reagan years. And double digit unemployment is no joke. But, Tony, many people believe that we have really already crossed the line. If you look at the most recent report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they come up with these alternative measures. So we know that the unemployment rate is 7.6%. But then if you add people who are marginally attached, that's like people who are working part-time but want to work full-time, and people who are discouraged workers and have dropped out of the labor force, we get up to a number that's more like 14%, 13.9%. So when we look at all the hidden unemployment, we're already well firmly into that double-digit area.
You know, we keep hearing these dismal job reports, but also that the news is, quote, worse than many economists expected, end quote. Does that include you? This is worse than what you expected?
No, because, first of all, I'm in North Carolina where everything that you've talked about, the furloughs, the layoffs, we've been seeing some of that stuff for a while. Secondly, I tend to be somewhat pessimistic about some of these numbers. So, you know, the basic forecast that most economists had out on Friday, the report comes out at 8:30 in the morning, and they were saying 7.5, and so it was 7.6. I figured that it would be something, you know, between 7.5 and 8. And, you know, our labor market is hemorrhaging jobs because there's no money out there, because I think that the Congress is fiddling while Rome burns in terms of a stimulus package. They were much more generous when it came to the bailout for banks than they have been when it's come to human beings. So I don't think it's going to get better, A, until we get some money in the pipeline and some jobs in the pipeline. I think cities and states, especially places like California, would want to start running proposals by their congresspeople about ways they can put people back to work quickly.
Well, let's talk about some of these banks and proposals that will help. The Obama administration is contemplating as a next step creating the so-called bad bank to store all of those toxic assets. I want to ask you how it works, but also to talk a little bit about the background on this, because I remember the Resolution Trust Corporation, as I'm sure you do, in the 1980s after the failed savings and loan debacle. Is this the same kind of thing, and did it work then, and would it work now?
It's the same concept as getting the junk, if you will, out of the mainstream financial sector and putting it somewhere where the government buys the asset and holds it, perhaps sells it or scrubs it up. As you remember with the RTC, they were banks were for sale pretty much, and they were pretty undervalued. The challenge with that is valuing a bad asset. In other words, if you've got a bank that they think it's worth, $100 million, the fact of the matter is their stock is worth maybe $70 or $60 million, they're going to try to get as much as they can from the government. And the government ought to give them as little as they can. And so you really end up spending a lot of time dithering and dickering about what it's worth. And the math is this. If the government pays them less, when the bank recovers, the taxpayers get more. But obviously, these bankers want to cover their back. RTC costs us a lot of money. The Resolution Trust Corporation costs the taxpayers a lot of money. And if we go to a bad bank strategy, I predict that it'll cost us a lot of money.
You know, the FDIC shut down three more banks over the weekend, two in California, another in Atlanta, Georgia. Are we still seeing, well, obviously we are because of what I just said, but do you anticipate even more bank foreclosings?
There is a possibility. We still have not seen the kind of bank foreclosures that we saw, you know, in the 80s with the RTC, with the savings and loans. And we certainly haven't seen anything like we saw in the 1930s. I believe the number of banks that have closed is something under 40 so far. And then many of them are small banks. That doesn't make it any better, especially for someone who's a depositor in one of those banks. But this is not the, of the crisis proportion that it could be. We do have many safeguards against bank closures. However, I expect, again, we will probably see 100 banks close. There'll probably be smaller regional banks, but some of them may be larger banks. You know, we have some challenges already with, of course, Bank of America and their merger with Merrill Lynch. And there may be some other large banks that are going to be challenged.
There's a voice that we have not heard a lot from lately, and I want to ask you about it. I'm talking about Fed Chief Ben Bernanke. He seems to have all but disappeared from the headlines. Why is that we aren't hearing more from him as the stimulus package gets debated?
Well, Bernanke's role is to manage U.S. monetary policy. What does money cost, bank regulations, all that stuff. So, frankly, he doesn't have very many arrows in his quiver yet left. I think we're down to under 1% for the federal funds rate. So there's not a lot of pontificating around interest rates that Bernanke can do. He ought to be a greater voice around the stimulus, especially around the strategy, the bad bank strategy you mentioned. I believe that what he's doing really is letting the Obama economic team get their feet wet. Very, very soon, we ought to be hearing that he and the Treasury Secretary have met. He's not an Alan Greenspan. If you think back to 1992 when Clinton was elected, Greenspan immediately jumped out there, and it was almost a jockeying between Greenspan and Clinton. And Greenspan made it clear, hey, I'm the money guy. I'm in charge of this, guys. And he went to the White House. He had a very long meeting with Clinton. It's been written about the Washington Post reporter has written extensively about that meeting. Carl Bernstein. Yep, he's written about that. So, Greenspan was much more one to position himself as aggressive. If we think about Bernanke, Bernanke's been in the role now for under 2 years or about 2 years. I wouldn't say that he hasn't gotten his feet wet, but I would say that he doesn't have the aggression that Greenspan had. And in many ways, that's good. But you're certainly right that his name, we aren't hearing from him. But I would expect it would be discordant if within the next couple of weeks, as the Obama economic team comes together, it would be very discordant if we did not see some photos of Bernanke going to the White House, sitting with the Treasury Secretary, sitting with Summers and doing some of that. If he hasn't done something like that in the next 2 years, 2 weeks, he's very much abdicating his role.
Let's talk about what some of the states are trying to do. We know that the president went to the Midwest today to try to pitch his stimulus plan. Out here in California, though, things are as bad as they are any place in the country, if not worse. And as a result of that, California is one of those places where the unemployment rate is higher than the national average, and there is a new system here now called Furlough Fridays. The governor has ordered state workers to take every other Friday off without pay. It's already affected the DMV, the Office of Emergency Services. Is this going to be spreading around the country, do you think?
Well, the furlough is a way of keeping people in their jobs and giving them a pay cut. So if you take 2 days off a month, that's a 10% out of an average of 20 working days in a month. That's a 10% roughly pay cut. And what he's doing is spreading the pain around rather than to say, let's cut X number of jobs. Let's just, cut X number of hours. This is consistent with a trend that we see nationally that the number of hours worked per week is down just a touch, not much, but just a touch. And I do expect that cities and states are going to have to be imaginative. Here in North Carolina, the public universities, blessedly not the private ones, but the publics have had to take a 7% cut, which means my neighbors at North Carolina A&T and my neighbors at UNC Greensboro are having to cut at least 100 jobs in each case. So, rather than have to physically cut jobs, keep people employed. So it's not a bad idea. It's uncomfortable, obviously, for everyone, but it's a way to share the pain.
Let's bring the conversation to a close with this. We're seeing pictures today of people standing in lines in Chicago and Atlanta trying to get a few jobs that are being offered. You're at a university, and it's coming up on the spring when people will be graduating, some with degrees in business, et cetera. Really briefly, Dr. Malvo, what are you telling your graduates about what they should do with a job market as dismal as this one is?
as dismal as the job market is, people are being hired every day. I mean, you still have some churn in the labor market, so people are being hired. I tell my students to be prepared, have that resume, make sure it's perfect, absolutely perfect. And that goes for everyone. Use your network like crazy, and follow up with people as quickly as you can. Standing outside is one way to get a job, but making telephone calls inside is another. Be wary of the internet. A lot of people are trying to find jobs on the internet, and they're putting out a lot of their personal information, social security numbers and other things, and that's just an invitation for some crazy desperate people to do identity theft. So be careful about what you put out there, but be as forceful as you can and get back to people as professional as you can. Get back to people as quickly as you can. If people offer you interviews at inconvenient times, too bad. Just do it, because these jobs are hard to come by. They're there, but they're hard to come by.
And I imagine that there's no major, really, that is the one that is recession-proof, is there?
There really isn't. There really isn't. I mean, in education, there are some opportunities. Social services, of course, are being cut. Business is being cut. So there's nothing, but there are pockets of opportunity in everything. The other thing I've told students, now to our listening audience,
don't be
afraid to take something part-time.
All right, that's good. Don't be afraid to take something part-time. Dr. Malveaux, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That was author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She is also the president of Bennett College. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Short on cash these days? What if you and your neighbors got together and started printing and exchanging your own greenbacks? Sound far-fetched? Or maybe even illegal? Well, it's not either of those things, and it's happening in more and more communities as the recession deepens and folks are scrambling to make ends meet. Equal Dollars is a 12-year-old local currency exchange system in Philadelphia aimed at recycling wealth, increasing savings, and adding to community cohesion. We've got Vanessa Williams, Corporate Assistant Director at Resources for Human Development, the nonprofit social service organization in Philadelphia that oversees the Equal Dollars program. Vanessa helped get Equal Dollars going in the late 90s and is still an active member. She even receives part of her paycheck in the alternative currency. Vanessa, thank you for coming on News and Notes.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've heard about this going on in Ithaca, New York, and the largest of these systems, we're told, is in Western Massachusetts. I believe they call it Berkshires there. They've circulated about $2 million in Berkshires in 2 years. So how do you explain this idea of local currency to the average person?
Well, we talk about Equal Dollars as a community currency and bartering system that essentially serves as a companion to the U.S. dollar. It's what maybe our ancestors did, like seeds, gold, silver, copper, beads, cattle, diamonds, spices, things that people have used over the years and centuries to expand their current way of acquiring goods and services. It acts as a non-interest-bearing, spendable, transferable discount.
So how does does it work in terms of, going to the store? Can I get on the bus with it? Can I catch a cab? Can I buy a refrigerator with it?
Well, you can't get on the bus with it yet, but you can buy, you could buy a refrigerator. You can buy basic needs. I've gotten my hair done. I've gotten plumbing work done using the Equal Dollar system. And essentially, the individual who offers to sell the goods or services is willing to accept a portion of their normal fee in Equal Dollars. And in that way, I get to save some of my U.S. dollar budget to put toward other things.
What does it look like? What does the money look like?
Well, it's changed over the years. I think when I first started with the system, it was huge. It was a note that was probably about 6 inches long and 3 inches wide. It then got scaled down to something about half of that size. And we are in the process of a redesign now, and it's a beautiful new currency that has some historical information about Philadelphia on it. And it is blue and green in shades. It's an attractive currency. currency that really speaks to the community.
We asked a representative with the U.S. Treasury Department about this idea of local currencies. Unfortunately, they have not responded in time for this broadcast. From what we understand here at News and Notes, it is legal to have local currency. It is illegal to have currency that is produced by the state. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Go on.
Our currency is produced sort of in-house with a printer that we utilize, that, and the printer has accepted payment in part in equal dollars.
It would seem that you would have to have some sort of agreement, Vanessa, in the community from both vendors and from people who are buying things to accept this currency and accept it at the value that it is set.
Yes, I mean, we talk to members about making sure that first the item or the goods or the services cannot cost any more than they would normally cost utilizing the equal dollars. So if someone is offering a service that costs $100 and they're willing to accept 10% in equal dollars, they would collect $90 in U.S. everyday money and $10 in equal dollars. They are not able to go above what they would normally charge. The 10 equal dollars that they earn, they are then able to seek out another member who has goods or services that they're interested in utilizing and enjoy a savings in their purchase with someone else in the system.
Break down for us what the advantage is to the individual as well as to the community. Now, you've already mentioned the 10% discount, perhaps, and that would be an incentive for an individual. But what advantage is there to the community to have these kinds of dollars?
Well, there's a great residual in that it builds a really great sense of community. Smaller businesses get more attention by people who might not have focused on them because they become a part of the system. You get people talking more about the local resources and not necessarily looking to external solutions. People come together. They recognize that they have opportunities to partner. We might have a member who does floral arrangements who is working with a member who does basket creation. And together, they decide they work out a relationship using equal dollars, but also utilizing each other's services, thereby also sort of being able to increase their earning capacity, offer something maybe that they weren't able to offer, or gaining access to something that would be difficult for them to do.
Final thing is, have you determined what denominations these dollars are in, and is that an evolving thing?
Well, it is an evolving thing. We started out with ones, fives, and tens, and twenties. And in our redesign, we may be adding additional denominations.
Are there risks involved in this?
Well, you know, it's the same risk that anyone runs with utilizing a business. If you go to the yellow pages and pull down a business that's listed, you run the risk, if you don't know them, of maybe not getting exactly what you want. We actually talk to our members about, you know, having good dialogue with a business person or the person providing the goods or services to make sure that you're getting what you want. And if anything, there's an additional advantage because they sort of make a pledge to provide their best and recognize that in this network, if they don't, people will come together and confront them in a way that's compassionate and focused on growing their ability to do better. We worked with coaches and staff who will actually sit down and talk with the business owner and say, you know, we got a complaint that the last cake you baked, you didn't deliver it on time. And talk to them about making sure that they're timely with their delivery. And those are the things that you don't necessarily get in everyday business interactions. It creates a sense of community accountability that is a wonderful way of getting people, again, to respect and value more of what we have locally.
The value of the dollar. Vanessa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Vanessa Williams, Corporate Assistant Director at Resources for Human Development, joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. The celebs turned out for last night's Grammy Awards celebration, but two high-profile artists were noticeably absent, and just about everyone has a Facebook account these days. So how much is too much to share on social networking sites? We have those stories and more on our Bloggers Roundtable. We have Liza Sabater, publisher of the community blog Culture Kitchen, Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News, and Sharon Toomer, founder and managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com. Hello, everybody.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Nice to have you. Before we get into the Grammy story involving Chris Brown and Rihanna, you know we have to talk about that. But before we get there, let's just briefly follow up the financial discussion that we just had with Dr. Malveaux. But I'd like to take it in a slightly different angle. Credit card use, or what some might consider credit card abuse, and not by you, but by the people who issue you your card. It seems some creditors have been monitoring where you buy things to determine how much your credit line should be. And according to reports, if you buy at the wrong store, that is, a store where other customers have had trouble paying their bills, you can pay a price for that by having your credit limit lowered, even if your credit is good. Liza, you heard of this?
No, actually, until Sonata brought it up. And although I have known of credit card companies basically having a system of surveillance, you know, for years, because that's, you know, it's called market research. Now, to use that in order to punish people and increase their credit, you know, their interest rate and fees and penalties is just ridiculous. It does talk to the problem that we have in this country, that we had way too much deregulation in the past 20 years. And so we have banks just running amok with every single ploy in order to, you know, abuse the financial power that they have.
Well, Eric, let me bring you up to date on this in case you weren't aware. And the investigation was done by one of the TV networks, and they uncovered this practice, which the company did not deny. But we know that credit card companies have information about our shopping patterns and purchasing habits. Just going to any major grocery store chain, those member cards are helpful for discounts, but in the end, you may be paying for it in ways that you had not expected, you know?
Correct. And one of the things that we do here in Michigan, you have the Kroger, you have the Meijer, and what they do is they use that information to offer you credit cards and or dictate what type of race you will even get. And there's something else I found out last year. You have a lot of tracking services that try to manage your account for you. Like if you go to the ATM machine and get some money, depending on what time of day it is, say if it's around 12 noon or 1 o'clock, chances are they know you're going to go to lunch right after that. And then they try to figure out where you're going. And once they find out where you're going, you get all kinds of bargains from those institution. Then you have another aspect of it where you have the healthcare industries monitoring where you use your credit cards and things like that to try to dictate how your rate should be for your healthcare coverage.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And Sharon, you know, the fact that they offer you discounts at those places makes it difficult not to take advantage of them, even though you're giving up privacy on the other end.
Yeah, you know, this sounds a whole lot like redlining and profiling, and this is all in the same vein. And I think not just with buying patterns, but also these companies, and particularly American Express in this case, has been accused in the past of targeting people who have subprime mortgages. So that means that in, let's say, New York City, there are a lot of holders of subprime mortgages in Black and Latino communities, not so much in Manhattan, but in some of the outer boroughs. So that's where I'm concerned, that this sounds a whole lot like in the same family of redlining and racial profiling.
Well, you know, Liza, speaking
not necessarily just racial, but, you know, just profiling.
Profiling, period. In this case, economic profiling.
Right.
Liza, you know, speaking of privacy, here's another interesting subject on what people know about you and what you may not know about your profile. And this time I'm talking about Facebook. First there was Friendster, then came MySpace, and now Facebook with more than 150 million users. Facebook is the social networking craze literally sweeping the world, and as Facebook use grows, so do the questions about, you know, the proper social networking etiquette. The latest thing that's showing up, though, is this thing called being dumped as a friend. I think they call it defriending. That's right. When you kick somebody off your list, but you don't tell them about it. Have you kicked someone off or been kicked off yet?
If I have, I haven't noticed. But there is, you know, this is extremely tied to the whole redlining through credit cards. We've lost a major chunk of privacy in this country, you know, again, to the fact that we're not defining data as something that we own. So our identity online, our activity online, is being considered something outside of who we are and not something that is intrinsic to our identity and who we are. So there's this movement on, you know, among technologists for OpenID, and not just OpenID, but portable ID, where my identity is mine and it goes with me to Facebook, to Twitter, to anywhere I go on the net, and also to whatever online stores or even contributing. You know, one of the biggest buyers of credit card and online data are actually political campaigns, because that's how they, you know, target people for fundraising and create canvassing profiles, you know, across the country.
Well, you know, in this particular case, I should just point out to the audience that this thing about Facebook defriending folks came to light when Burger King, of all people,
yes,
got the
exactly,
idea
that they had
right,
a whole thing about
marketing
if you defriend 10 right, people, we'll give you a free cheeseburger or something.
Yeah,
like that.
It's crazy in a sense. Now, Burger King has said that they are not doing that any longer, Sharon. But I don't know. Is this something you should be concerned about if you are on Facebook?
I've been defriended.
Ouch.
But it made sense. It made sense. I was thrown off, and I found out by accident also. And you know, it made sense after it was explained that, do I really want to see who this is an ex-boyfriend is? Do I really want to see who he's friending, and does he want to see who I'm friending? So it actually made sense, but not, you know, I don't have a whole lot of friends, first of all. But I would like to say this about the information. I'm amazed at the amount of information that people share about themselves on Facebook or any other area and think that it's somehow private. And right, what Liza was saying is absolutely true. If you notice that on my Facebook page, because of my age, I know exactly what kind of I get these advertisements on the side panel. Mm-hmm. You can always tell what the age is because they cater to, you know, according to age. Mm-hmm. There's somebody picking up all of that information, and mm-hmm, you know, it isn't just because you don't see banners flying around the site doesn't mean that there's not a product service interest in Facebook. So I just caution folks, especially grown folks. Have you seen the 25 lists that people
just to be careful. Let me ask you to hold that thought, because I want to talk about this some more, and I want to give Eric an opportunity to jump into the conversation. But we have to take a short break, so just hold on. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Sorry, Eric.
Oh, no.
Before Don Imus, before Howard Stern, there was Petey Green.
People use drugs because drugs is good.
He was outrageous, bold, daring, and always in your face. Green was a legendary shock jock and TV talk show host. But to black residents of Washington, D.C., he was much more. Petey Green was the voice of the African-American community. A new documentary on the life of the charismatic broadcaster and community activist premiered this month on PBS. It's called Adjust Your Color, The Truth of Petey Green. Joining me now to talk about it is Dewey Hughes. He was Green's longtime friend and manager, and was played by the actor Chiwetel Ejiofor in the movie Talk to Me.
Good morning.
Good. How are
Maybe
you
it's afternoon some
well,
places.
Well, it's going to be different times in different places. It's nice to have you in the studio, Dewey.
Thank you very much.
You gave Petey Green his first broadcasting job at WOL Radio way back in 1967. He was a former heroin addict, a convicted felon, fresh out of the joint. What made you give him a job?
He was a prison mate of my brother at Lorton Reformatory. It was a prison for D.C. inmates, and my brother used to talk about Petey all the time. And in fact, so much that, you know, I stopped visiting him. I'd go to the prison to visit him, and he'd spend most of the time talking about Petey Green. So on one of my visits, I'm looking at some alligator shoes across the way, and I look up and I see that this guy is an inmate with some expensive alligator shoes. And I said to my brother, how in the, I guess I can't say what I
no,
want to
don't say.
Say that. Okay. Does an inmate get to wear alligator shoes in prison? He said, that's Petey Green. And that's how I first met Petey.
And now Petey was on the air, quote unquote, in prison.
Yes.
With
yes,
the program, he, making jokes, which is, that's a tough thing to do, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, he did it. He was the best at it. He could go straight up in the face of an enemy and break him down and make him laugh and make him think about something funny and humorous.
The documentary was really very insightful. Petey was a straight talker, to put it mildly, and he was known all over Washington, and yet we don't know about Petey around the country. He didn't have a national reputation. Given the power that he had in the nation's capital, why was that? He didn't expand beyond that base.
Many opportunities that Petey would participate in, right up to the 11th hour, he would find a way to sabotage anything that had any national overtones to it. He was strictly a D.C. dude who loved the people in the community first and foremost, and anybody outside of that would take a time away from that. It just wasn't for him.
Now, you got him a shot on the coveted Johnny Carson show, right?
Oh, took 3 years of begging and worrying a friend who was a talent coordinator, and a shot opened up. And he called, and we got up there, and Petey did the sound check, the light check, and when it was time for him to go on, he was nowhere to be found.
He blew off the shot to
blew
be on Johnny Carson.
Yes.
Why did he do that?
There again, sabotaging something that was going to take him away from the people in the community in D.C.
Man, you have to see the documentary to really appreciate who he was. There are clips of him, and I wasn't familiar with Petey Green. Having seen the documentary, though, I can tell he really had an impact on the people there. One of the persons upon whom he had a great impact, I didn't know this either, was Howard Stern.
Big time. I mean, Howard actually decided to make that move into the real shock jock. He found the combination to the lock by just studying and watching Petey just let it all hang out.
There's a scene in the documentary where Howard Stern shows up on the show with Petey in blackface and an Afro wig, and the N-word is just flying all over the place.
Yes. There were no holes barred when it came to having contact with Petey Green.
Now, his family, that's a part of the documentary and his life that we don't know a great deal about. He talks a lot about his grandmother who raised him. And yet there's a scene where you see a couple of his children, but then you don't see them again. What happened with his family life, and how was that impacted by his notoriety?
Well, his family life was as good as it could be based on Petey's family was the community, okay? I mean, his priority was someone who needed help or needed a kick in the pants to begin to straighten their lives out in the community. He loved his family, and his drinking got in the way of a lot of quality time that he could have shared with his family. But, you know, I mean, we're talking Petey Green here, a guy who beat all odds to stand up and give a voice to a people that still, to this day, really don't have a voice. I mean, when you look at the hip-hop community, they represent what Petey Green was all about in his way, you know, saying things that people are thinking but would never say it because politically it could destroy your opportunities to move from here to there. But Petey, he did not care. Part of him not caring was because I had his back.
You had his back?
I had his back, 100%. I had his back. I was the only one who would fight for the right for him to stand behind a podium in places where nobody would ever even think to...
Our time is short, but briefly tell me, Dewey, why did you do that? You seem like a button-up kind of a guy compared to Petey Green.
I'm not really a button-up kind of guy. I played the button-up kind of guy role to be successful in the media game in Washington. I'm more Petey Green than Petey Green in some aspects.
Really? Don Cheadle played Petey Green in the movie. How successful was the film, and what did it do to help change, if at all, the perception of Petey Green, particularly among those people who knew him like you?
Well, there are a lot of stories, but my favorite story is a young man who was locked up in youth authority. And in fact, I used to mentor his mom when she was a teenager, and he's like 19. He has watched this movie talk to me 19 times. And his mom said that he's never been interested in anything like that. I mean, this guy, Don Cheadle, Petey Green, the whole journey motivates this young man. And there are lots of stories in reference to Talk to Me that are really, really wonderful. It wasn't the box office success, but it continues to find audiences all over the place. And I love it. I really, really do.
Dewey, thanks for coming in. I wish we had more time to talk about Petey Green. He was a fascinating character, for sure. I've been talking to Dewey Hughes about his friend Petey Green. The Washington, D.C. radio and television host died of liver cancer in 1984. The new documentary, Adjust Your Color, The Truth of Petey Green, airs on PBS stations throughout this month. Check your local listings. You can also pick up the DVD at pbs.org.